Look, I wanted to turn to Aristotle's remarks in chapter 4 and 5 of book 8 of the Physics concerning self-motion. You know, self-motion is something he does associate with animals and being distinctive of animals. As you know, one of the distinctive features of Aristotelian physics is that change, which is what the term motion refers to generally, kinesis, is something that is something that has an aspect that is determined by the nature of an entity. That is, what it is determinative of how it moves. And this holds across the board. So instead of there being laws of motion that apply to matter as such, and that is to things irrespective of their nature, how things move is determined by their nature. So that Earth will move, if not prevented so, by other extrinsic factors, move down, air and fire will move up, etc. Now, that the nature of something is the determinative of how it alters. And here when I spoke of movement, I meant locomotion in particular. But again, this is going to be applied across the board to change of any sort. Aristotle will make arguments to the effect that locomotion has a kind of basic role to play, that it's changes in position over time. That argument play a determinative role in other kinds of changes. But those other changes are not just going to be determined by motion or just be reducible to motion, but they will be facilitated by motion. Now, when we speak about something by nature tending to move in a certain direction, it's not equivalent to saying that it moves itself. And Aristotle is going to speak about self-motion as something particular to animals. And he makes, he points out obviously that those things that can move themselves can also be moved accidentally. They can't be moved by other things. And in some respects, their attempts at self-motion can be frustrated. But when we're talking about self-motion, it's something that can only apply to an entity that contains a plurality of parts. What is continuous, what is homogeneous, cannot move itself. And moreover, not only is what moves itself something that has to have parts, but it does not move itself as a whole. Well, let me put it this way. Its whole does not move, nor is its whole itself moved. Instead, as he puts it, there is the entity or the animal can move itself. And one might say it can move itself as a whole, but that's only insofar as there's one part that imparts motion without being moved, and another part which is moved. And this nevertheless allows us to talk of the animal organism as moving itself as a whole. Now, connected with this is the consideration that these parts must be in contact with one another.
That's why locomotion is the primary paradigm for all motion, because contact is necessary for the other kinds of change as well.
So I think we want to just think back about what this would signify and how we think about the animal organism, how we might try to think of this in any kind of physiological way, and what are the arguments that Aristotle makes in defense of this. Now by the way, this notion that we think of self-motion in terms of something consisting of parts, where one part moves the other without itself being moved, is a situation that duplicates itself in, well, you could say throughout both Aristotelian and you'd say Platonic philosophy, when one comes to consider things that are thought of as involving, broadly speaking, self-determination, self-motion, self-alteration in any fashion. There's a remark in the Republic where Socrates is discussing self-control and points out how we can't make any sense of self-control. And the argument he gives is the same as an argument Aristotle gives here, where in context of self-control, Socrates says, how can there be self-control? How can the same thing at one and the same time be both controlling and controlled? Because self-control seems to require these two opposing features pertaining to the same thing. And the implication, of course, is this sort of would violate the principle of non-contradiction, and that allegedly this makes it unintelligible. And on the basis of this, Socrates now introduces two differentiations that are going to become determinative of how, in the Republic, one is to think about the body politic and, in analogy, the soul. Both are to be thought of as being divided up, so that when we think about ruling, we don't have self-rule. What we instead have is the ruling of a ruling part, a ruling class, in the case of the polis, imposing form upon a subject class. Or alternately, in the soul, a ruling part and irrationality, imposing its order upon the irrational part of the soul. Now, Aristotle does the same thing in his Politics. Even though he will speak about political association as ultimately being concerned with justice and an association of equals, in a sense, he doesn't allow them to ever engage in self-rule. Rather, there's always going to be a ruler ruling upon others, but those on whom the ruler rules, if they're citizens, are going to themselves have a chance to rule over other citizens. But never is one to think of government in terms of self-rule. And the same thing applies in De Anima, when you look at his account of the soul, and the rational soul. Then again, there is a passive intellect and an active intellect. There is no aspect of the soul that acts upon itself, that acts upon another part of the soul. Just as in the polis, there's a ruler acting upon the ruled. You don't have self-rule. Now here, when we come to animal motion, the same things seem to be applied. The only way we can make sense of self-motion, that is the organism of a whole, is that it's actually divided up into two parts. One part that is going to move the other part without itself being moved. And in that way, the animal as a whole can originate motion, and in that regard be thought of as being moving itself. Now, there are two arguments that at least I see Aristotle giving here that pertain to locomotion itself. Or actually, they apply to motion in general, actually. And chapter 5, I think, crystallizes that. If you look at chapter 5, section 257A32 following. You know, Aristotle writes the following. He says that now it is impossible that that which moves itself should in its entirety move itself. For then, while being one and indivisible, it would as a whole both undergo and cause the same locomotion or alteration. This would be the same. This would at the same time be both teaching and being taught, etc. So what is this argument resting upon? What is the basis of this argument, which wants to preclude that which moves itself would in its entirety move itself, or for that matter, as you will say elsewhere, be moved in its entirety?
Has to be an actuality acting on.
Well, I think that's a different argument. And we'll look at that in a second. I mean, here what seems to be the problem he's pointing to that precludes the possibility of something acting upon itself as a whole.
One thing can't be both mover and moved.
Yeah, I mean, again, it seems to be this unwillingness to accept that there could be a contradiction, or that something could involve, let's say, contradictory aspects. And therefore, just as you can't both teach yourself and be taught, by the same token, something can't move itself and be moved. Can't have both at the same time. Now, on the other hand, he has another argument, which I think is what Brad is referring to, where he says, and this is based on Aristotle's conception of motion, and here it's kinesis in general, motion in general, that motion, in a sense, is something that involves a potential that, you know, is as he says, an incomplete fulfillment. You know, Aristotle will speak of kinesis, and what's his general definition? I don't know if any of you recall it.
It's the actuality of a potential as such.
Yeah, the actuality of the potential as potential. So it's something that remains a potential, because if something is in motion, it hasn't arrived. It hasn't come to the end of its motion. And presumably the motion is thought of as having an end that lies beyond itself. So it's always something that is a potentiality that remains a potentiality. But the mover, Aristotle claims in the next point, on the other hand, is already an actuality. And he gives us an example. Well, you know, that which is hot produces heat. And in general, that which produces the form possesses it, has to have it, has to have the actuality of heat. So that here signifies that the mover can't also be moved. The mover can't be in motion. Why? What would that require? That in a way, it only be an actuality potentiality, not of actuality, but it has actuality. So here's this other argument he invokes to try to preclude there being a way of thinking about self-motion. Nonetheless, we think of the animal as being something that moves itself as a whole, but that signifies that there's a part that is an unmoved mover, and it imparts motion to something else. And on the other hand, he speaks about these two as having to be in contact. That is, the unmoved mover in the animal must be, in some respect, directly in contact with that which it is moving. Now, he doesn't say too much about what that amounts to here, but you might want to think about what that would signify. You know, the unmoved mover in the animal organism is going to be something that will make other parts of it move. And here, if we're talking about locomotion as a characteristic aspect, not the only thing, but a characteristic aspect of animal self change, Then we have parts that are going to be set in motion by something in the animal that is not set in motion. So something is going to be able to set the rest in motion without doing so in terms of any kind of motion. And that would also seem to involve without itself being set into any kind of change in general, because here Aristotle is referring to motion in general. And if you think about how this refers to the unmoved mover as the original cause of all motion, and remember that Aristotle makes an argument, or he makes an argument in the physics, that motion has to be eternal. Because you can't think of motion just beginning and starting, because in a sense, the so-called beginning of motion is itself a change. And here we're talking about motion, we mean change. You can't think of change starting from a state in which there is no change. Because when it starts, that's a change. And so you have this infinite regress. So there has to be change going on continuously. So the unmoved mover, which is that on which change depends, is going to be eternally doing its thing of generating change. And to the extent that locomotion is itself primary and underlies all change, then the unmoved mover has to be setting into locomotion eternally in an unchanging, continuous way. Some entities, in Aristotle's scheme of things, the heavenly bodies, whose motions are then somehow or other going to be translated into all the other kinds of changes that occur in ways that may not be entirely intelligible. So now you have to ask yourself, well, what would this mean in terms of the animal organism? The arguments that Aristotle gives in the metaphysics, where he's speaking about the unmoved mover, end up having to think about the unmoved mover as being immaterial. Because anything material has potentiality, and thereby is subject to change and being moved, shall we say. Whereas the unmoved mover can't be, it has to be completely actual, and that means it can't be material. And then there's the question, well, how does it relate to the other factors? How does it impart locomotion to them? It can't do it in terms of a material way by impact or anything of that sort. And what does Aristotle rely upon, for those of you who are familiar with the argument in metaphysics? What is it alleged?
The soul.
What's that?
The soul. The heavenly bodies must have an aspect of soul to be moved.
Yeah, or that they're moved in what way? In terms of what kind of causality?
By desire, love.
Yeah, by love, by sort of a final causality. I think you want to question whether that makes sense. Because ordinarily a final causality means that something moves itself for the sake of achieving some end. But in what respect can the unmoved mover depend upon anything else? There's nothing that anything else does that in any way contributes to it. So it's not clear that this account really makes much sense. Now you want to ask yourself, how would one apply it within the animal organism? We're going to have something that is going to be, you might say, presumably immaterial. Because if it's material, then it has potentiality, then it's subject to being moved. And you might ask yourself, well, if something is material, could it at the same time, even if it is subject to motion, at the same time without being moved, generate motion in something else? That's another possibility one might consider. Now note, here we're dealing with a different situation from the one that Aristotle takes up when he's considering the source of all motion, which leads him to this unmoved mover that is eternally doing nothing other than thinking itself, and thereby somehow or other setting some eternal locomotion going on which all other change depends. But here we're not faced with the problem of accounting for the source of all movement. We're talking about the movement of a particular entity, an animal. So, and moreover, we're talking about a movement that is not eternal. Right? because we're speaking about movements that are not always the same. We're not talking about circular motion that continues forever. We're talking about different kinds of motion. Motion that starts and stops, that's could be rectilinear, or it doesn't have to be circular, to take various forms. So we're talking about an origination of motion that is not eternal, and is not just determinative of an eternal motion either. And it's possible that that aspect which causes motion need not necessarily be completely immaterial. Right? Could it perhaps be a part of the organism that is subject to some change, but at the same time has something about it that allows it, without being acted upon, to have the ability to set another part in motion? Now, Aristotle will elsewhere speak about how metabolism will enter in as something that will allow the animal organism to move itself. He will make remarks to that effect on occasion. And obviously, that seems to fit the bill. The animal organism, in order to maintain itself as something that in any respect is self-moving, does depend upon a relation to other. That somehow that relation to other provides something which will allow it to move itself, which is to say, what is outside it does not determine its motion. Its motion is still going to be internally determined, but the enabling condition of its self-motion will be found outside itself, nonetheless. Which would signify also, presumably, we're dealing with something that has a material character. It has some potential, right? Because it can be subject to changing states, some of which will allow it to be able to engage in motion, in moving the other part. And then presumably it moves the other part by being in some kind of contact with it. Without being moved. But I think you want to think about this in regard to questions concerning the aspects of the subjectivity of the animal organism and what it means for it to have a centralized subjectivity that has to, that's at stake in its having feeling, self-feeling, as Hegel put it, sensation, as having the ability to move itself in the sense of locomotion. And to think whether we need to bring into play the kind of distinction Aristotle is making between a part of the animal that moves other parts without itself being moved by anything else. And whether we have to think in those terms. And think about something that in moving other things might have enabling conditions, but its activation of the other parts or its moving the other parts is not itself caused by any particular movement. And whether that's a way of thinking about what's going on in the animal organism. Now, Hegel is going to speak about there being a soul in the animal organism, in the way in which there is not a soul in the plant. And he's not going to speak of soul in connection with nutrition, as Aristotle will. But he's speaking about that as a basic aspect of soul. He will first speak about soul proper in connection, well, perhaps in any full-fledged sense in the animal. Although, what might to some degree undercut that association of soul with the animal organism and not with the plant is how Hegel deals with the logic of life in the science of logic, because there, Emre, what does he do that might call this into question to some degree? Because I know you've done work on this.
Well, you mean in logic, or?
In the logic, which as the logic of life would pertain to any kind of exemplification of life.
Well, he lays out essential specifications.
And among them is what? At least he makes mention of it. It can be debatable how it operates. But it does refer to soul.
Yeah, sure.
It does refer to soul there, in terms of life as such. So, look, we're not dealing with that discussion here, but there's obviously some distinction being drawn in Hegel between the way there is a soul in animals, where there's a soul in a respect that is not to be found in plants. I think we want to consider, well, how are you to consider this the soul? Is it something that's going to be akin to what Aristotle seems to be imputing as a source of animal motion, which allows the organism as a whole to move itself, namely that we regard thinking a part as moved by another part, where we think of the activity of the organism as being one in which there is, shall we say, a ruler that acts upon something other than itself? Or is there a way we can think of the organism as involving self-determination, self-rule? And how that's the case. So I think keep that in mind as we proceed and think about the animal organism. And likewise, when we come to think of mind, to think about that as well. But certainly Aristotle, like Plato, will want to think of the mind as involving the same kind of division that to some degree is here being imputed between what might be regarded as, in some respect, the relation between mind and body, or soul and body. I'm not saying in Hegel, but I'm saying what Aristotle might be intimating. Any thoughts or questions about these sections in Aristotle? You know, note how he makes the argument, you know, based on the certain claims concerning actuality and change, the relation between the two, and claims concerning how there's something contradictory in the idea of, well, self-change, self-determination, self-rule, any of these kind of self-acting processes. One has to think of the activity as being one where one thing acts upon something other than itself. And this, by the way, is going to be the basis for Aristotle making use of categories of craft in connection with both politics, the mind, and the organism, even though at the same time he's going to distinguish craft activity from what's involved in ethical conduct, from what's involved in aspects of thought and life. What is it about craft that will make it an appropriate way of speaking about how a ruling agency acts upon a ruled part? Or how one part imposes change upon another part without thereby changing itself?
The matter is separate and the craftsman imposes the form on
matter. Yeah. So we have this agent acting externally upon something else, imposing new form upon it in some fashion. So the craft analogy is imported into the discussion about politics, the soul, and here life, even though at the same time it's recognized that if you want to think about any of these domains as involving some kind of self-activity, you got to think in other terms. And once again, the key stumbling block to applying the craft analogy to politics and perhaps animal life as well as the mind is that the controlling part is part of the whole on which form is imposed. Which makes it difficult to apply craft categories. Because craft is something that acts upon something other than itself. Now you know that Aristotle wants to make use of a craft analogy to apply to the life process. And what is the analogy he uses to do that? We discussed it earlier, I think, briefly. But it's just worthwhile to think about it. And why there's something inappropriate about it. What do you recall? Yeah. The doctor who treats him or herself. Now, this might appear to apply to life to the extent that life, could be said to be, in some respect, self-sustaining, self-determining, fixing itself without requiring something outside itself to do that. But what is true about the activity of the medical practice of the doctor who acts upon him or herself and the healthy condition to which that activity is directed? What does that healthy condition make superfluous? The activity of the doctor, right? So in other words, the activity of the self-curing doctor is directed at upholding a condition that is given by nature without medical practice. It's because it's somehow been disrupted that you need to bring in medical practice. But what medical practice is doing is reestablishing something that doesn't include it. Whereas the life process is reproducing its own activity. So for that reason, it's going to be something of a different character. And that you know, makes one want to think about whether, in thinking about self-motion, whether we are going to be able to speak about an unmoved mover and moving something that is not moving itself. And how we want to think about this. And then there's also the question of contact, how we think about the contact. All right, well, what I suggest we do is we now begin our look at Hegel's account of the animal organism. And again, I want you to keep in mind that we want to think about, first of all, whether we can consider there to be this dividing line between plant and animal life that can be regarded to be part of life forms as such, you know, something that can be articulated within the universal biology, and to be on the lookout for things that may enter Hegel's discussion that might pertain only to forms of life that are either contingent upon the peculiarities of the planet Earth, or alternately, whether in characterizing the nature of animals, he ends up using features that pertain only to certain forms of terrestrial life, animal life, and not a completely generic. Now, Hegel begins in paragraph 350 by speaking about what he calls organic individuality and how organic individuality, which is something that is to be found in life as such, exists as subjectivity insofar as certain features are realized. And these features are realized specifically in the animal organism. So there are two things that Hegel points to in this paragraph 350. One is that the externality proper to the shape is idealized into members. And the organism in its process outwards preserves inwardly the unity of itself. So it's the two sides. You could say the differentiation in space, in terms of its shape, its outward manifestation of the organism, is idealized into members, gliderin, or organs. And then the organism in its process outwards preserves inwardly the unity of itself. Now, when he speaks about idealized into members. What is he referring to here when he uses this term, idealized?
Things like limbs that have limbs and other external things that have a particular set number, a particular arrangement that has to belong. That's why they're members.
Well, I think it, you know, you're bringing in there being a definite number and so forth is obviously going to be something he will bring into. But I think there's the general point is that we're talking about, when he uses the term idealized, this refers to a logical term, ideality, which he refers to as something that is to be thought of as an internal differentiation of something. That is, we're dealing with something with a differentiations that do not have their being apart from the whole to which they belong. And that when we're talking about the, in a sense, the physiological differentiation of the parts of the organism, they're going to be such that they remain of such a character that they can only be as part of the organism. And the other side of it is that the organism can only be insofar as they are there as well. Without that kind of looseness that you find in something akin to plant growth, where, as you may remember, Hegel had pointed out earlier, the mere fact that the plant grows in a way where there's just a kind of duplication of parts indicates that the plant can get along without any specific number, because it kind of indifferently accrues more and more of them, which means its existence is not tied to any specific amount of them. And that indicates that in some regard they have a kind of independence from one another. This goes back to that remark of Goethe, that the more parts are like one another, which is to say, they don't have a difference that binds them to one another. Here they're the same, and it's kind of indifferent how many there are. That indicates that they're not as subject to the unity of the whole. So here we have the sense that organic individuality has subjectivity to the extent that its own differentiation is pervaded by the unity of the whole in a kind of exhaustive manner. And then secondly, the organism in its process outwards maintains the unity of the self. And allegedly this is not the case in the plant. I mean, what aspects of the plant in its relation outwards would suggest that it's not preserving inwardly the unity of the self? What features might we associate with that not present?
Divisibility.
What's that?
Divisibility.
Yeah, they have a kind of quasi-independence. The parts, the shoots, the buds, and so forth are almost like independent parts. So you may remember Aristotle says we don't have genuine universality. I'm sorry, Hegel says we don't have genuine universality to the self. Rather, we have these particulars that are the parts of the plant are like particular plants as opposed to proper members. And they are outward. They are the relation of the plant to what's outside itself. And then there's the other side. If the plant or the organism relates to what's outside itself in a parcelized manner, in a, let's say, localized manner in the way of tropisms, where different parts of the plant are sensitive by themselves without any relationship to the whole, to certain things, and react on their own, that's different from something where the relation to what's outside involves the unity of the self in every respect. Well, in the animal we have this. In the animal, Hegel says, the animal nature, the actuality and the externality of the immediate singularity, the immediate individual being of the organism, is something that reflects the self. And the self that he speaks of as being a subjective universality. Now, why speak of it as a subjective universality? What is the point here of invoking this term universality?
sense that all the parts belong to the self.
Yeah. I mean, this subjectivity pervades all aspects of the organism in terms of its activities, in terms of its sensitivity, its irritability. I mean, you can think about all the different processes that are associated with the life in general. You know, first of all, the internal organization of the organic unity. You don't have this kind of indifferent hold of the differentiation as you have in the plant, where the unity does not thoroughly specify the differentiation, right? The differentiation has a kind of freedom to it, where how many parts there will be is a matter of indifference. It's not contained by the unity of the plant. The plant is, in a sense, continually going beyond any set limit that's attached to its individuality. Whereas in the animal, the internal differentiation will be different. Its relation to what's outside itself in its whole metabolic process is always going to be something that engages the subjectivity of the organism as a whole. At least it will be distinguished by that. And then on the other hand, with regard to the sexual process or reproduction, let's say, it's also going to be something that is going to engage the organism as a whole, as we've already seen intimated in contrast to the plant. So, in discussing these aspects, Hegel brings in talk of soul in the addition to this paragraph. And one way he speaks about the animal having a soul, he says that in a sense, the animal in a way just sort of, as he says, arrests its relationship to another that you find in the plant. It's not directed by light in the way which the plant is. Instead, it is more thoroughly related to itself in whatever it does, as opposed to being related to something else in what it does. And we want to think about how self-relation enters into all aspects of what are the distinctive processes of animal life, how it remains self-related in a way in which a plant does not, in its sensitivity, in its irritability, in its reproductive process, in the genus process. Whereas somehow there's an aspect of externality, of dispersion, of kind of independent to the parts, where in all of these processes the plant is not as, shall we say, self-related, so thoroughly self-related as we find here. And this self-relation is something Hegel characterizes here on page 352 in a way, referring it to all of the functions of life, where he says the subjectivity of the animal consists in preserving itself. In other words, in upholding itself and being in relation to itself, as opposed to, in some respect, becoming something other. In its own bodily nature, in its own internal formation, in its contact with the outer world, its metabolic process, and as this universal remains at one with itself, and presumably also pertaining to the genus process. So Hegel will use this logical term, the animal is going to be for itself, it's going to be self-related in all the domains of its activity. But he will make one qualifying thing about animal life in general, and that's at the very end of paragraph 350, where he will, in a sense, distinguish animal life in general from what could be considered rational animal life. And he says that in animal life in general, and this is still a life in which one can speak of a kind of soul, something that's in relation to itself, pervading everything in all of its functions. This subjectivity does not relate to itself as pure universal subjectivity. It's not for itself as pure universal subjectivity. And he says, why isn't it? Because it is not aware of itself in thought. Or you could say it does not relate to itself in thinking itself, in conceiving itself. It only has feeling and intuition. That does not mean that there won't be animal forms, obviously, maybe the rational animal, that will be related to itself in thought, will be able to have a concept of itself, will be able to be, let's say, self-conscious in a conceptual manner. But here we're talking about a way of being related to oneself in feeling, in intuition. It doesn't require concepts. It doesn't require thoughts. And yet they still involve a way of being in relationship to oneself. And I think already you get a sense of how that's going to operate, right? We've seen how kind of centralized sensitivity of sensation will involve that. The centralized motility, as Jones would put it, and in a way the centralized activities of reproduction, sexual relations, and the like. And there'll be ways of thinking about this as involving matters of, let's say, feeling. If you think back on Jonas, sensation and urge, and we'll want to think about how these things enter in. And in saying all of that, I think we're at the stage of considering to what degree this way of talking about the subjectivity of the animal, to which Hegel will associate the term soul, is tantamount to speaking about animals having minds. And how, in a way, the possession of a mind is going to be ingredient in all of these life functions as they operate in the animal, in order for the subjectivity to have the kind of relation it does. Well, we want to think about whether that's going to be the case or implied, and to what degree. And then to ask, for example, whether sponges have minds or clams have minds, in some rudimentary sense, or not. Now, part of this, in paragraph 351, Hegel gives us a preliminary sort of description of features that characterize the animal, and that in a way exhibit this kind of self-relatedness, this kind of subject, universal subjectivity. And he gives us, in a sense, five features. And then we're going to see how they enter into the different aspects of the life process. One being the formation, that is organic unity, the other being metabolism, the other being the genus process. First of all, the animal has freedom of self-movement. It spontaneously determines its place. And this will be something that will distinguish it from plant life. And you want to think back on what Jonas had to say about what distinguishes animal life. Note how Jonas had spoken about it in terms of, and he was focusing in a way on it. And if you ask yourself, if you look back on Jonas, where did he locate, in a sense, the crux of what makes the animal soul an animal soul? What was the unifying principle, in effect?
Sentience that arises from a central nervous system, because I took it.
Well, still, what did he tie all of that to?
Mediation.
Yeah, the mediation, the mediated existence, the character of his metabolism, in a way. That seemed to be, in a way, his jumping off part. Note how what Hegel is doing. He's speaking about a principle that really is not alien to what Jonas is doing, but he's sort of speaking about it as pervading all of the features of the animal life process. So we have, on the one hand, freedom, self-movement. He also speaks about voice. Now, what is voice?
internal self-movement.
Yeah, of what kind of movement?
Vibratory.
Yeah, vibratory. And interestingly enough, Hegel will speak about animal heat as being to some degree associated with that. You might ask, well, what's the connection? But what does heat involve? It might be connected in a way, and in a certain sense is connected to vibration. Yeah, I mean, it's molecular motion without something changing its position as a whole. Right, so to some degree, the voice, if we're talking about, we're here talking about the way in which the animal organism can vibrate itself freely. And by the same token, it can generate heat on its own. It generates heat in a way that is different from plants in some respect. Its metabolism will provide for this. To some degree, you'll have voice being part of it, but voice will be something different, right? You'll speak about voice in other dimensions. One thing about voice as a feature of animal life, what question could one raise about this as a distinctive feature?
You could ask about cold-blooded animals. Well, they don't generate heat.
Well, first of all, do they have a voice? Some do. In fact, many, many do. On the other hand, what I'm raising the question is whether we think of everything that can count as an animal as having a voice. Maybe not. It may be something that only an animal can have. But whether all animals have it is another matter. We might even look at the question of self-movement. Do sponges engage in self-movement? Do we want to characterize them as animals? If so, on the basis of what? So I think, you know, keep in mind, we here have features that may only be features that belong to animals. But we want to ask, which of them are going to be universal features of animal life? Right? How would we look into this? Well, in any event, we have, here he speaks about self-movement, he speaks about voice. And as you know, voice is going to be something that will be, as he says, indicative of there being sentience. There'll be an outward manifestation of sentience. And we'll want to look into that in what way it will be. It could be thought of as having that character. If animal heat, then he speaks of something that, of course, Jonas brings in, how the animal does not engage in a continuous, shall we say, metabolic absorption with what is immediately at hand. Instead, it has an interrupted intake or into susception. And that's tied to the fact that in its metabolism, it is related to individual factors. Now, he speaks about them as being inorganic natures. We want to look at that later on. That is, even though Hegel at the same time has just indicated at the very end of the discussion on plants, that plants in a certain sense are for the sake of animals, that animals will live off them, he still speaks about metabolic processes involving the animal dealing with individual inorganic matter. And I think, you know, we want to look at that and think about that. And then he says, above all, it has feeling. Above all, note, he's giving this a signal presence. And he speaks about this as being the existent ideality of being determined. Now again, you want to ask yourself, well, what respect is this an idea? Why speak of ideality here, of being determined? If ideality refers to this fact of something being what it is in terms of its belonging to the whole, how are we to think of that in terms of feeling? I mean, feeling obviously is a kind of, it's a determination of the organism, which may well be localized in various ways, but nevertheless, if it's, as he says here, idealized, or the existent ideality being determined, what will that aspect mean? What will be what will allow it to be something that has that connectedness to the whole. I mean, one way of looking at it is that in feeling, as opposed to localized sensitivity of a plant, the self, the subject, the universal subject, is relating to its own determination, the determination of itself, and a self that pervades all of its particular determinations. So that it is the same self that has this feeling here, as well as this feeling in another part of itself. It has this other type of sensation, maybe based upon a different sense, but they're all part of a unified sensitivity. So there isn't any, you know, there's this so-called binding problem, which some people, particularly in the empiricist tradition, bring up, namely, you have all these different senses. And then the question is, well, how do the sense data coming from these different senses, and we could also say just from different parts of the body, even with the same sense, how do they get connected up as sensations of the same object? You know, what allows them to be unified? Well, if they're already unified as sensations that the self knows or apprehends to be its own sensations, that is, in feeling, it feels its own feelings, the feelings that belong to the same subject, then the problem of binding really doesn't quite arise. There's this unity underlying things from the very beginning. Well, here we have these features. Hegel emphasized in the addition that we're dealing with ways in which the animal is self-related. It relates to itself as a self that pervades all of its determinations. And he points out that in this way, the animal, because it has itself as its object, because it relates to itself in its sensitivities, it feels itself. It's self-feeling. Because it's feeling its own determinations, its own modifications. Even though they're going to be the basis for feeling something other than itself, or sensing other than itself. You know, as Hegel will point out at various junctures when he discusses sentience, you know, the character of sentience is that there's an idealization of everything outside the organism. Right? The organism is being determined by something outside itself. To the extent that it's sentient, it deals with determinations of itself. And in dealing with determinations of itself, can be aware of what is outside itself, what is other than itself. And this has to do with what Hegel identifies as the theoretical relationship to another that the animal has, that the plant does not have. Now, why does the plant not have any a theoretical relationship to the other? And what is a theoretical relationship to the other? What is it? I mean, theoretical relationship obviously is being contrasted in a way with a practical relationship. Right? It's a relationship to the other that is not itself involved doing something to the other or altering the other. You know, sentience in general is not specifically doing anything to the other, although of course there are aspects of sentience like taste and smell that depend upon some degradation of the other. That's least of all, let's say, in sight or hearing, which, you know, as Hegel will say, as Aristotle will say, these are the most theoretical senses because they let the object free. That's one sense. I mean, the plant is immediately involved in a kind of practical relationship with what it senses by having this tropic reaction. It's immediately there. In what respect might one say the animal does not, even if its sensations could be regarded as stimuli? Why is it not something that's immediately connected with altering what it senses, and thereby being in a practical relationship to it.
Perceive at a distance.
Perceive at a distance, and also its metabolism is something that is not continuous, right? So it can be sensitive to things without being engaged in a practical relationship at the same time. And there's the other side of it, namely that this theoretical aspect has to do with the fact that there's this unified apprehension. You know, the other is left free and counts as an other, or as Jonas would put it, you know, you have the opening up of the world as a world precisely because you have this unified sentience. Whereas, on the other hand, if you have this sensitivity that is just localized, it's just a sensitivity to that which is an immediate, or having an immediate impact upon it. Which here, the unification of the theoretical allows it to have the world as a whole, to be in relation to the world as a whole. Which clearly it can't be in a practical relationship to the world as a whole, right? So that, in a sense, carries with it that to be in relation to the other as another, the totality of the environment, the biosphere, let's say, to be in relation to all of it, in a certain respect, is to be in a theoretical relationship. So the other is left free, it remains in existence, yet it's still in relationship to the subject. And as he says, here in this theoretical relationship, the animal posits as ideal externally caused modifications and can therefore tolerate it. Now, when we say posits as ideal, what do we mean by this? I mean, because clearly we're talking about a sensitivity that is based upon an interaction with the world, which means that the world is having an impact upon the self or the organism. Otherwise, the organism is not, let's say, sentient. But in what respect are these made ideal? Well, think of it this way. You know, if you're sentient, you sense your own sensations. Even though they are at the same time sensations of something else, they are equal to your sensations. They are in you, so to speak. They're in your unified field of unified sensitivity. They have that dual character. And that's going to be basic here. Well, listen, why don't we stop here, and we'll delve into the discussions of each of the aspects of animal life. And I think it will be interesting to think about how the different functions of the animal organism are, and quite obviously are involved in its own internal organization. Because obviously, the internal organization of the animal organism, like that of any organism, is connected to all of its life functions. Right? All of the life functions require a certain kind of structure to be engaged in. So it will be interesting to see to what degree there's more of a difference between these different functions than in the plant organism. Even if in some respect there can't help but be obviously an interconnection between them. So any thoughts or questions right now? Okay, keep in mind, by the way, that we're going to have this extra class a week from Saturday. We can just think about what time you'd like to have it, because we can be flexible. I'm thinking of having it in my house. Think of that Saturday, and think how it will fit your schedule. I know some of you may be going to the Georgia Phil Society at Oglethorpe, is it?
Yeah.
And usually that, I don't know if they have papers after lunch.
They do. 5 o'clock.
Till 5, really. All right, well, look, let's discuss that and see what will be. How many of you are thinking of going? Anyone else?
I have considered it. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah, okay. By the way, there is a talk, as you probably know, on Friday by Robert Brandon, which will be discussing things to be found in Hegel in connection with Davidson's theory of action. So that will be at 3:30. And there's a sign-up sheet for having lunch or dinner with him on Friday. So he's quite a prominent fellow, I think. worth taking a look at. Interacting.
Tomorrow, right?
Yeah, tomorrow.
It was fine, yeah. When I was through my other seminars, I was like,